speak. Your silence is commanding.
Please be seated. Good afternoon. This is our last oral argument before September, we hope. And we want to invite you all to join us today to say thank you to Deputy Marshal Jack Bagley, who's standing in the rear of this room. This is his last oral argument, he hopes, before he retires, which will be quite soon. And he has served the court and the people of the state of Wisconsin well for 18 years. And it's because of his work and that of others that we managed to get here relatively timely with all our briefs and other papers. And for that, we want to thank him and wish him the best in his retirement, and that he and Mrs. Bagley have many years of enjoying their retirements. Thanks, Jack. If you're going to speak, you have to come to the podium. I want you to turn on the lights.
Pleasure and an honor. Thank you.
Thank you, Jack. I'd like to call our last case, 02-2817, James Cape & Sons Company versus Terrence D. Mulcahy. Arguing on behalf of the Department of Transportation is Assistant Attorney General Charlotte Gibson. Ms. Gibson.
Good afternoon. Your Honors, this is a case that's taken on a life of its own as it's gone through our court system. The question is whether CAPE, a contractor bidding on a large highway project, was entitled to rescind its bid based on an error without paying the forfeiture it agreed to as a condition of that bid. In answering that question, the Circuit Court and Court of Appeals each developed their own new standards for determining when a bidder is entitled to rescind its bid without forfeiture. Each of those tests is inconsistent with the statutory standard set forth in 660901. This court explained those requirements very articulately in Nelson v. Storage Commission, and there's no reason for Wisconsin to depart from that standard today.
Counselor, the errors that were in Nelson were not the type of errors that are present here or were present in Crazen, correct?
I'm not sure where to take your question. Okay. Are you saying the kind of error or the number of them?
Let me be a little more specific. Well, the number was different as well. But in regard to the kind of error, there were items that were necessary functions to carry out the bid in Nelson that simply were not included. It wasn't just that they put in a wrong number for an item, as was done in Crazen, or that the wrong number, as was here. There were functions that they simply hadn't included correctly. Isn't that right?
Well, actually, the bidder took a lot of time and apparently care in calculating those items and had them on some kind of draft proposal. All he failed to do was transfer them onto a final bid sheet. I argued that that was an omission that didn't involve the exercise of professional judgment. And, in fact, his testimony was that they were omissions because of the excitement of bidding.
And he also didn't report them until quite a long time after, where CAPE reported the error promptly, right away.
I think it's important to keep that issue, though, separate from negligence. The statute has two separate requirements. Nelson ultimately was found to meet the timely notification requirement. The department has never argued here that CAPE didn't, but that doesn't answer the question of negligence.
So when you're looking at the timely notification requirement, are you looking at the second clause of the statute where it says that there was an error omission on the bidder's part in the exercise of ordinary care in examining the plans or specifications and in conforming with the provisions of this section? Is it that latter part and in conforming with the provisions of this section that you are interpreting as the timeliness function?
I kind of focus on that shall immediately and without delay give written notice.
Okay. All right. And just so I'm clear, you don't agree with what I've implied in that the errors in Nelson had to do with examining the plans and specifications?
No, I don't agree.
Okay, fine. Thank you.
But Nelson does set out the standard here is a general negligence standard. That's what Nelson sets out.
That's right. That's what Nelson says.
And the state's position then is that do you think this matter was fully tried? Obviously not. You're here and you don't like the outcome.
Right. When you first think about the negligence analysis, you think, well, why was this decided on summary judgment? Because negligence is so infrequently a proper topic for that. What makes this statute a little different in its application is the fact that the bidder is required to prove a negative. And so unlike most cases where the plaintiff's got to come forward and show negligence, here the plaintiff's got to come forward and show freedom from it. And I think in this case there was so little presented as establishing an ordinary care standard that summary judgment was appropriate.
And there's no question that Nelson has noted was a different type of situation. I mean, we can distinguish this case from Nelson, at least situation-wise, fact-wise, from what happened here.
Again, and I go to Justice Rogenczyk's analysis. Obviously, the Nelson bidder did make more mistakes. I disagree that you can categorize his errors as the professional judgment type of error so that you could start looking for some kind of a clerical per se exception.
Tell me why you are hesitant to distinguish Nelson from the facts of this case. I mean, or the flip side of the question, why do you think Nelson controls?
And you're again on the factual question of negligence?
That's correct.
I think that the bidder in Nelson was more negligent than CAPE was here. The question is whether CAPE met its burden of proving freedom from negligence. I think Nelson really wasn't a difficult case. The bidder made so many errors and really failed to provide any evidence that the standard for that he'd met some kind of standard of care that seems clear that was an easy negligence case. This is a somewhat harder negligence case, mostly, I think, because CAPE made a single error and not many. And I'd like to turn, while we're on the subject of negligence, to the Court of Appeals clerical error exception and how it used clerical errors as a per se exception to Nelson, to negligence, I'm sorry. There is no per se excuse to negligence based on whether an error can be characterized as clerical. A clerical error may result from negligence just as easily as an error in professional judgment. If a bidder fails to use a calculator, for example, on a multimillion-dollar bid, for example, it has been just as negligent as a bidder that failed to correctly take into account a river's current in calculating work to be done at the riverbank. CAPE's own cases demonstrate that clerical errors can and do result from negligence. In the cases CAPE would rely on, the courts note that the clerical errors at issue resulted in negligence. They went on to conclude that they wouldn't be using a negligence test, so there was no bar to relief. But that's not a possibility here because our statute plainly requires freedom from negligence. And under an ordinary negligence analysis, the court's task is not to characterize the error as a clerical or judgment error and be done with it. The task is to look at the conduct surrounding the error and evaluate that relative to what a reasonable person would have done under the circumstances.
Ms. Gibson, does it make any difference when the state is notified of the error? For instance, if you're notified before the award rather than after the award, does that make a difference in the test that you think should be applied?
No, and we've argued very strongly throughout this case that there is no separate standard for relief depending on when the bidder notifies the public authority of the error. Now, there is actually a separate standard if you make your notification before the bids are opened. Then you're required to rescind and you're done with it. But once the bids are open, there's only one standard for relief if it comes down to the point when you need it, and that's only when a forfeiture.
Here the bids had been opened, but an award had not yet been made.
That's right.
I'm a little bit curious as to whether or not this is standard procedure for the Department of Transportation to have something like this occur be notified before the award and yet proceed to make the award knowing that the error had been made in the bid. Is that something that happens with some frequency in the department?
I'm not sure with what frequency they're notified of errors that they determine are not free from negligence. It's important that this is not a strict liability standard. It's certainly possible that a bidder could come forward and say, look, I've made an error, but I exercised ordinary care in preparing the bid, so I'd like to rescind without forfeiture, and that the department would grant that. In the practice of the department, as you see from the record, there's a longer time span between the opening of bids and the award. In some of these municipal bids, they can be awarded right there at the bid opening, so there wouldn't be that gap even taking place.
But your argument here is that, well, everybody else did it, in other words, corrected their bid, and you didn't correct your bid, and even though it was before the opening. Isn't that kind of like gotcha? I mean, are you worried about enforcement here, that if you would lessen the standard, you would have trouble with people not being as careful with their bidding? That must be the policy behind this.
Absolutely. The public bidding process requires great attention to making sure that bidders are honest, fair, and careful in their bids, because from the perspective of the public authority, this process is a black box. They really don't know what's going on. They don't know if we've got a bunch of careful, honest bidders out there or if people are in the back room doing bid fixing. And so the only way that the public authority is going to be able to analyze what's really going on, and then ultimately if there's a forfeiture, the only way the circuit court is going to be able to analyze what really happened is to do that factual analysis under the negligence test.
Now, I have a question. Are you going in under the last sentence or the next to the last sentence? Which do you think applies here? Under sub 5.
You mean the third or the fourth sentence of sub 5?
Well, are you going under, if the discovery and notice of mistake, omission, or error causes a forfeiture, the bidder may not recover the monies unless it's proven before a court that there's no mistake.
That's right, because ultimately what we're deciding is...
Is that what you want us to interpret?
Because we're here deciding whether they're entitled to a judicial relief.
Right.
That's the sentence.
Well, what causes a forfeiture? Why is why does their discovery cause a forfeiture?
A forfeiture is caused because the public authority determines that the bidder is not entitled to amend or rescind its bid. The bidder turns out to be the low bidder with the bid as bid and awards the contract.
Okay.
And then if the bidder decides not to perform, obviously.
I see. So here there was a low bid, which was accepted even though there was a claim of error.
Right.
And so that causes the forfeiture, and therefore you don't think the bidder showed it was free from carelessness, negligence, or inexcusable neglect. What's the difference between carelessness, negligence, or inexcusable neglect?
The Nelson Court interpreted them as synonymous. I see them all as just ordinary care.
So legislature is just redundant.
Right. It's actually somewhat helpful, particularly helpful here, because when you look at the equitable rescission doctrines in other jurisdictions, sometimes they'll start with the word negligence and then move to other terms like gross negligence, culpable negligence, willful negligence. This is just some of the cases do that. And it's helpful here that the legislature really hammered home, we're just looking at ordinary care.
We don't have gross negligence in Wisconsin anyway, do we? It's not a concept that we have in our law, is it?
I don't know.
Counsel, the argument is asserted, though, that this type of error is not the error that involves the examination of the plans or specifications, and that it's only that kind of error that triggers the forfeiture. Can you respond to that?
I'd respond to that with several points. First of all, if you just look at plans and specifications, even if you assume that the third sentence created an enforceable separate standard for relief, plans and specifications and plans and specifications isn't all that that sentence talks about. It talks about also complying with the rest of the section, which we know from subsection 7 requires ordinary care in preparing the whole bid and checking the proposal before submitting it.
Do I recall, that's a question for me, not for you, I guess, a footnote in the Court of Appeals opinion that says that you've conceded that this is not an error that was in the course of the plans and specifications? Whether or not there is a footnote there, are you conceding that or are you not conceding that?
And I wasn't counsel below, but my reading of the record is that the concession was that the error didn't result from a failure to look at the plans and specifications.
Yes, it's footnote number 7. The department acknowledges in its brief that the fact that CAPE's mistake did not involve examining the plans and specifications.
Right, but the department didn't concede that they complied with the rest of 660901, including the requirements of subsection 7. Second,
Counselor, can I interrupt for just a minute? Looking back at the statute, we would never get to the third clause that begins with if there are three. The first if clause says you discover the mistake before the bid's open. The second if clause says you discover the mistake and determine whether it came from a failure to examine the plan specifications or conform with the provisions of this section. And the third if clause it says if the mistake causes forfeiture. We never get there if the department doesn't award the contract, correct?
That's right.
Okay, so what motivation does the department ever have not to award the contract? Because it can't keep the bid bond unless it puts everybody into that third clause of the statute.
Well, that's kind of a pessimistic view of good government.
Well, it's also a view of government that's short on money by a whole bunch.
The department and other municipalities who administer this have an interest in having the bidding done in an efficient and appropriate way.
Right, I agree with that. I wouldn't quarrel with you about that.
And, you know, one thing, if they feel comfortable with it, if they're convinced that the error occurred despite the exercise of ordinary care, they can say, okay, we'll let you amend the bid up by the amount of the error, and let's see if you're still the low bidder.
But, you know, when DOT responded to this, what they said is there is no provision in the statutes for releasing you from your bid.
Well,
and they took a position right out of the box that wasn't based on the statute that said we're not giving you your money back, essentially.
What the letter actually said is there's no provision in the statutes allowing you to correct. And you can argue with their interpretation right. and amendment, but they didn't say that about rescission. And it's important to keep those two concepts separate. They didn't say that CAPE wouldn't be able to rescind its bid without forfeiture. They just said that they weren't going to allow correction.
I see. Okay. Thank you.
If I can just get back to the...
Could I ask, if the bid error had been discovered before the bids were opened, what happens then?
If the bidder is discovered before the bids are opened, the bidder is required to notify the public authority and withdraw his bid, and he can't participate in that bidding anymore.
Okay. And if the bid error is discovered immediately afterwards... that's what we're talking about.
Right.
Before the contract is awarded, why should there be such a difference? I mean, how is the government hurt by that? Could be a time delay of moments.
Right. Well, the crucial fact here is that until the bids are opened, the bids are sealed and the process is blind. So if everything's going as it's supposed to, the bidder has no idea what the other bidders around him are doing. But the moment the bids are opened and read, and they're typically publicly read, the bidder looks around and says, oh, my goodness, my bid is really low. I've left money on the table. Now, if we have sufficient checks in place, we're not worried that the bidder can use pretextual mistakes to get out of the bid or try to amend the bid and craft it around everybody else's. But if we don't have those checks in place, then the system becomes a kind of get-out-of-the-contract-free card where the bidder is just changing the bid all around and you don't have a sealed bid process anymore. It's an informational moment. That's why it's so critical.
Well, shouldn't there be a different result if the low bidder wants to withdraw and really doesn't have any plausible reason for withdrawing? I mean, in this case, weren't they able to identify a specific, objectively specific error?
Well, the statute tells us we have to look at ordinary care, too. But I think, and this is something some of the case law talks about, well, can they put their finger on the error? But let me just give you an example of a time when a bidder could identify a mistake that would entitle them to rescind, say, under a plans and specifications test. The bidder bids on a project that involves a supply of steel. And after the bids are opened, he looks around and says, oh, geez, my bid was really low. And he goes back through the bid, and typically there's a lot of different information in the bids, a lot of different elements, and says, boy, are steel prices rising. That was a mistake I made. I looked carefully at the plans and specifications. I didn't think enough about steel, but that doesn't matter because that's not covered. So I want to amend or rescind my bid and up it by, you know, to double the price of the steel I'm going to be using on the project. So it's both inconsistent with the statute and really bad policy. And if I can just get back to the problem of creating an enforceable standard for relief in the third sentence, I think it becomes really obvious that it doesn't work as a standard for judicial relief if we test it out in a case where the bidder is not entitled to relief, even if we apply the circuit court's plans and specifications test. So let's take a bidder who bids. He submits the bids are read, hears everybody else's, and he says, oh, no, this was really too low. And he goes to the public authority and says, I'd like permission to either amend my bid or rescind it. And the public authority sits down and says, well, I'm going to apply that circuit court test. So they take a good look at it and say, well, no, the bid resulted from a failure to look at the plans and specifications. And, by the way, you're the low bidder, so we're going to award you the contract as bid. Now, the bidder doesn't want to do the contract at that price, so they say, no, we're not going to do it, and the forfeiture's imposed. Now they show up in circuit court, and the question is, what standard applies to grant them relief? So the circuit court would say, the whole thing is determined at the point of notification. So since he notified before the contract was awarded, all you look at is whether he looked at the plans and specifications. But the fourth sentence of that subprovision says really clearly, when a mistake causes a forfeiture, you have to prove freedom from negligence. In that case, there's just no way to reconcile circuit court tests with the plain language of the statute.
Well, Counselor, you could say that you never get to the third section because there is no reason to award a contract to someone who gives you notice and wasn't based on the failure listed in the second clause.
Yeah, but my hypothetical is different. My hypothetical is somebody who did make an error and failed to look at the plans and specifications. So here we are. Not everybody's going to be entitled to relief, I hope, even under this test. So you end up needing the judicial relief anyway because the forfeiture is going to be imposed. And at that point, the statute absolutely says you've got to prove freedom from negligence to the judge.
But do you have to prove freedom from negligence in looking at the plans or specifications or freedom from negligence in regard to anything to do with the bid?
Freedom from negligence regarding the entire preparation of the bid. And I just want to emphasize that looking at the plans and specifications is such a tiny part of preparing a bid.
Well, that's how they decide what the tasks are. I mean, it's hardly a small part of the bid, is it?
Well, it's really just a first step, though. You're just looking at it, and then you're using your professional judgment and knowledge to construct a bid and figure out, well, what subcontractors am I going to need, and what kind of materials, and what are the labor conditions, and what's the weather going to be like at that time of year? None of these things have anything to do with reading those plans and specifications.
Well, I think I guess I beg to disagree with you just a little bit on that, but it's not relevant to our discussion here.
Do municipalities ever make errors in their plans and specifications that they have to change?
You mean once the contract's been awarded, they realize it, or the bidder notifies them?
Is there something, if let's say the state puts something out to bid and they make an error, does the successful bidder able to just boy, we got you. You made a mistake, and now, like that. I mean, is there a flip side to this?
Well, if the contract starts and they're doing the work and the bidder says, hey, you all made an error in how you did this. We're going to have to do a change order because the work to actually be done is different. Obviously, the state can enter into change orders and change the compensation. I think if the error is in the bidder's favor, I think it would be hard for the state to go back and get the money back. But all of that is governed by the terms of the contract and the performance bond. That's not the statute.
You know, the amicus brief asks us to adopt a per se rule for clerical errors. And, of course, then the next case is what's a clerical error? You know, you can make that very broad. Is there any type of a clerical error that you would agree with the amicus on that ought to be a passable error under the statute from DOT's position?
From the perspective of negligence, I don't think we should be looking at the kind of error. We should be looking at the conduct given the facts at issue. So there's certainly lots of mistakes where the conduct met a standard of ordinary care, but it happened anyway. There are lots and lots of errors like that. But I don't think the way to identify those is for the court or the bidder or the public authority to try to label those errors as being clerical or non-clerical. I mean, as our discussion about Nelson showed, it's that's a moving target.
Okay. Thank you.
So what is it you want this court to do?
We're asking the court to reaffirm the holdings of Nelson that the freedom from carelessness, negligence, or inexcusable neglect standard applies whenever a bidder has notified the public authority of an error in its bid after bids have been opened.
Not to make a special distinction to clerical and non-clerical.
That's right.
Or a distinction as to care in examining the plans or specifications.
Right.
Straight negligence.
Right, which is what Nelson did a long time ago, and it seems to have worked pretty well this time.
And in this case, you think it's a question of law as to negligence? You think it's a question of law as to the negligence or lack thereof?
I do, because of the fact that CAPE was required to prove his freedom from negligence rather than the opposite.
Why do you care so much? 100,000 here or there?
Oh, well, it's not really about the amount of the forfeiture for the department. What it's about for the department is ensuring the integrity of the bidding process. These are huge high-stakes contracts. This contract alone is over $16 million. This is taxpayer money. And these statutes have always been construed by this court as being for the benefit and protection of the public and not for the interests of individual bidders.
Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Attorney Cindebrand, representing James Cape and Sons Company.
Thank you, Your Honor. First, before I begin my formal presentation, I would like to comment on some oral argument by Ms. Gibson that I think is not correct and reflected in the record. First of all, the DOT, prior to its brief to the Supreme Court, did not contest that CAPE had satisfied the standard under the middle section. It's actually the third section of subsection 5. And it is the freedom from or the exercise of ordinary care, both in examining the plans and specifications and in conforming with the provisions of this section. Indeed, in the Supreme Court brief, DOT does not explain how CAPE failed that particular test, but it is indeed the first time that they refer to CAPE not having conformed with some undisclosed provisions of Section 66.0901, and that is reflected in both the trial court's oral decision from the bench as well as the Court of Appeals decision, which Justice Rogensack reflected or referred to. Secondly, I believe that Justice Rogensack was correct in her recollection of what the DOT decided initially when CAPE requested an opportunity to correct or withdraw, and that is there is no authority to correct, and if you withdraw, you lose your $100,000 bid bond, period. And that is, it's in our brief in the appendix page 113, and that, of course, was before the Circuit Court and the Court of Appeals as well. Section 66.0901 is the public bidding statute, and we all agree it is designed to protect the public by ensuring openness, honesty, and integrity in the bidding process. Subsection 5, which is a remedial subsection to that statute, reflects at least three principles in implementing the larger policy. First, bidders, like all people, including public owners, make mistakes, and it was the intent of the legislature to codify an equitable rule that allows bidders to correct errors. Secondly, the opportunity to correct errors protects against potential bidder fraud or other mischief in bidding by limiting the opportunities to correct after bid opening and by establishing a particular standard of proof at two different distinct phases after bid opening. But the opportunity to correct also protects the potential owner and the public against a favoritism and bias by the owner in letting of public contracts and by protects against discouraging potential bidders, which is something that the Court of Appeals also acknowledged. And it does that by defining the opportunities for correction and the basis for correction. This is an important principle, and it is the foundation of the equitable rule, which stems from the Moffitt decision, which we cite towards the end of our case, in which they criticize the public owners for what they characterized as a grasp of steel, the opportunity to say, gotcha, you made a mistake, and we're going to hold you to it. That is the foundation of the equitable rule, which has now been codified in subsection 5. Our discussion of the meaning and the application of this subsection recognizes these principles. The best interpretation and application, and we grant that this has to be interpreted. It is not a particularly clear statute. But the best interpretation is one that harmonizes these policies, consistent, of course, with established rules of statutory construction. Both the trial court and the Court of Appeals carefully analyzed this statute. Their analysis, setting up the three scenario or recognizing the three scenarios within the statute, satisfies the underlying principles that I've just discussed. Both courts recognize that the statute on its face and as discussed in the Turtle Lake versus Overdahl case contemplate three scenarios: an absolute right to withdraw for pre-bid opening discovery of errors, an opportunity to correct after opening but before award if there is timely notice and evidence that the error was not due to failure to exercise ordinary care in examining plans and specifications and in conforming with the statute. And thirdly, a right to recover a bid guarantee if there is a forfeiture based on the, what I'll call just the excusable neglect standard, but it is carelessness, negligence, and freedom from carelessness, negligence, and inexcusable neglect. This scenario and this temporal analysis is correct for a variety of reasons. First, it gives meaning to the entire statute. It establishes what the import, what the purpose of the examining the plans and specifications and conforming with the statute means. It is consistent with the legislative purpose in adopting the equitable rule in the Moffitt and the Gavahan cases. It fosters and balances the policies of providing relief for honest mistakes while protecting against the risk of manipulation or mischief by either the bidder or the public authority. It does not create a risk of mischief by bad actors. The error must satisfy the standard, i.e., that it is not due
to carelessness in examining the plans and specs or conforming with the statute. And the bidder bears a burden of proof. It must show that its error satisfied that standard. Mere allegation is not enough. I note that in one of the cases cited by the state, the Colella case out of Pennsylvania, they were concerned that a plea of error may be enough to satisfy a right to relief. That's not the case under this standard. It's evidence of error. And there is no dispute, there has been no dispute, either by the DOT in its decisions or at the time of the circuit court decision, that CAPE had satisfied that standard. Rather, DOT has argued exclusively that that is not the appropriate standard. The three-part test, or three scenarios, also recognizes, as DOT does not, that there is a significant benefit to early notification and a rational basis for distinguishing between notifications before and after the award occurs. Before an award, there are other bidders. If there is a correction and that bidder is no longer the low bid, then the next lowest bidder, the real low bidder, has an opportunity for the contract. After the award, there aren't bidders anymore. Rather, there is a contract. And if the error is discovered or notified after that point in time, it creates a big headache for the municipal owner and for the bidders as well. Do we allow it to correct? If we allow the contractor to correct at that point in time, don't the other low bidders have a right to have their bids reconsidered? Because now it's not the low bidder anymore. These types of dilemmas can occur at the point in time when the public owner is ready to move forward. Public owners don't always award the next day. They typically award when they're ready to proceed. And at that point in time, there is a time sensitivity that requires them to move forward, and the problem of having an error to deal with defeats that value. So there are distinctions.
Now, do you, you're obviously here to win, and you won at the Court of Appeals, so you want it affirmed. But do you buy into this clerical kind of error discussion in the Court of Appeals? I mean, you think that's the best way of interpreting this statute?
Justice Abrahamson, first, of course, we do want to win. We think that the Court of Appeals' preferred interpretation, as opposed to the interpretation that they applied, is the appropriate response by this Court. And so, yes, we want the Court of Appeals affirmed, but on somewhat different grounds. We'll take it on any grounds, of course.
I understand that.
So I just wanted to clarify that.
How do you phrase the best interpretation?
The best interpretation, how I visualize this statute operating is as follows. And we can dispense with the pre-opening type of discovery. There is a discovery that occurs after bid opening,
right,
but before award. If the notice is timely.
What does timely mean?
Timely is going to depend on the circumstances. For example, in the Nelson case, the trial court had concluded that it was untimely because it was weeks later and on the eve of award. The Supreme Court, however, looking at it, said, well, in the context of the way the facts unfolded, that was reasonably timely. And so that is going to be a fact-specific situation. I grant you that. And if the evidence establishes that it was not due to carelessness in examining the plans and specifications and conforming with the statute, and I'll get to what that means in just a moment, then there is a right to relief. Now, that relief may be correction, or that relief may be allowing the contractor to withdraw its bid. Obviously, if it's still going to be the correction, it's still going to be the low bid, it is in the public owner's interest to allow correction. And I might add that under this interpretation, it is the only interpretation that provides an opportunity to actually do what is the what the courts have said is the manifest intent of the statute, to allow correction. Under DOT's interpretation, there's only two things that happen. One, if it's before opening, you get your bid back, it's rescinded or withdrawn. And if it's after opening, you get your money back or not. But the DOT would account for no opportunity to correct at all. So if the bidder satisfies those criteria, then you don't move any farther forward. You either correct, and either you're the low bidder or not, or you allow them to withdraw without penalty, and you move on to the next bidder or the next project.
Mr. Cinderella,
if it doesn't, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
What has been the practice? I mean, this statute's been around a long time. What has been the practice? This isn't the first time that the department has sought forfeiture, has it?
Well, first let me clarify that this statute does not even apply uniquely to the DOT or the state. It applies to virtually all public owners. School districts are not part of it, but otherwise it's almost all public owners. The record does not indicate what the historical use or practice is. We obviously know what the cases say, and I think that the DOT's letter, which Justice Rogensack had referred to and which I referred to, is revealing, because at least as of October 13, 2000, the DOT had taken the position that there is never an opportunity to correct, and if you withdraw, you do it at the peril of losing your bid. I don't know what the historical practice has been at DOT. I don't even know if the historical practice comports with what they said their interpretation was in this particular instance.
What did the Court of Appeals do wrong, in its opinion?
I don't think the Court of Appeals did anything wrong.
You said you weren't quite in accord with their application of
Correct.
Their reasoning.
Yes, Justice Bradley. I believe that the Court of Appeals felt constrained by the Nelson decision to adopt this two-tier approach. I don't think the Nelson decision mandates that result. The Court of Appeals recognized that if the Nelson decision does mandate that result, it is not the better interpretation, and hence urge DOT to seek review here. I agree with the Court of Appeals that the Nelson decision does not reflect the better interpretation. I do not believe that the Court is as constrained by the Nelson decision. Certainly this Court is not as constrained.
But Nelson didn't come up with this ministerial clerical distinction.
Nelson did not. And that goes to the second question, which Justice Abramson has asked, and I still haven't gotten to it, for which I apologize. The Nelson case goes more to the issue of whether that third sentence has any independent meaning. And the Nelson case just didn't address that. It wasn't an issue in that case. I believe it wasn't an issue in that case for two reasons. One, nobody raised it. But two, the factual context in which this arose, the Nelson case arose, was a review of a trial court decision that said the request was untimely, and so we moved to the last standard. So I don't believe the Court of Appeals should have felt as constrained by Nelson as they did, but they did. And now we're in this court, and I think this court has more flexibility in how it treats precedent. Certainly we have to respect it, but we don't necessarily have to agree if we find that it is not appropriate to the situation at hand. Getting to Justice Abrahamson's question of the clerical judgment distinction. I believe that the use of the term clerical and judgment, which is not unique in Wisconsin, it's been used elsewhere, does not fully capture what it means. It's a shorthand. And what the term clerical means really are those types of ministerial type errors that do not involve the exercise of judgment, the calculated decision-making, the exercise of any sort of skill or expertise. They are the type of errors that occur when one makes a mechanical type of mistake. And that also distinguishes what happened in the Crazen case and in the Attorney General opinion, where there was transpositions of numbers or incorrect reading of numbers, and what happened in the Nelson decision, where the owner on more than one occasion did not include a number for a required part of the bid. In another instance relating to something called a Y wall, he said he spent an enormous amount of time looking at it, reviewing it, and calculating it, and still got it wrong. Those plainly do not fall within the clerical side. Those are more what we call in shorthand the judgment side. I think that there is one of the federal cases, foreign cases, I believe it's the Marana School District, that put a good spin on it, if you will, or characterized it appropriately. There is a negligence or inexcusable neglect standard there, but what they held is that the clerical, mechanical, mathematical type errors are the type of errors that satisfy the negligence or inexcusable neglect standard, whereas the other types of errors likely do not, maybe not in all situations, but likely do not satisfy that kind of standard. So I believe that that is an appropriate analysis. I believe it comports with the intent of the statute. I believe it enhances or perpetuates the value of providing a clear and objective standard for the agencies to apply.
I'm not sure I understand this, but it seems to me, under the next to the last sentence, I think what you call the second sentence, if the bidder makes an error, omission, or mistake, which your client did, right? Your client made an error, omission, or mistake.
Yes.
Right. And discovers it after the bids are opened, that's this case.
Yes.
The bidder, your client, shall immediately and without delay give written notice. Did do that, right?
Yes.
And make known the fact of the mistake, omission, or error, which has been committed, right?
Yes.
And submit to the municipality clear and satisfactory evidence of the mistake, omission, or error.
Yes.
And it's because they just didn't update another subcontractor's
A late estimate. Bid, okay. A change in a sub-bid. Yes, Your Honor.
So far, we're okay, and you fit right in, right? And that it refers to mistake, omission, or error, right?
Yes.
Was not caused by any careless act or omission on the bidder's part. If we stopped there, you'd have a little problem. Because it was caused by mistake, omission, or error. We've already conceded that. But you got, in the exercise of ordinary care in examining the plans or specifications, right?
Yes.
And you're saying this was not an error by misreading the plans or specifications.
Correct.
Therefore, you fall right within there, right?
And the last portion, too.
Sure.
And in conforming with the provisions of the statute, yes.
Okay. So you ought to get your money back. That's your point.
No. It never should have gotten to the point where there was a risk of forfeiture.
Okay. All right.
We should have had a correction at that point in time.
Okay, fine. Didn't happen. They took your low bid.
Correct.
All right. So if they take your bid and you then fall within a forfeiture issue, is that right? If they take your bid and you don't want to perform, those are grounds for forfeiture, right? If the bid was taken properly.
If the agency was, or the public owner was correct in denying relief under the third section, then you get to the fourth sentence, correct.
You don't think we're in the last sentence?
No, Your Honor.
Yes, you are, Your Honor. You don't think you're in the last sentence.
You are correct.
Right. As usual. All right. Okay. So that's why you think you come within that. But of course, okay.
It's the Krasin case puts it well, because if you satisfy the right to relief, and they said for the 6 versus O type error, the municipality should have granted relief, then you can't get to the forfeiture section. And that's our point, Your Honor.
Because once you get to that forfeiture section, if you fall within that last sentence, with all due respect, you got a major problem. Because you did make a mistake, and it's hard to say it was free from carelessness, like negligence or inexcusable neglect.
Unless one applies, well, if one applies the clerical versus judgment distinction, then I believe there is no dispute that it would fall within that clerical ambit. If one did not apply that analysis, then there is a factual question that would likely be inappropriate for summary judgment resolution. And that is something that's presented to a court.
And that's how the Court of Appeals gets out from that last sentence, through clerical.
I think that's how they decide it correctly, but yes, that is the analysis.
Can you tell me why you think the legislature would have carved out a relatively narrow area in the whole process, that is, the examination of the plans or specifications, and that is the only area of negligence, if you will, or lack of exercise of ordinary care that is involved? I mean, it just seems to me such a small slice of what you're trying to get is a whole bidding process, an honest bidding process that's done once, that's certain, and then let's get on with it.
Yes.
And by carving out this negligence or the lack of exercise of ordinary care that only deals with when you're looking at the plans or examining the specs, as opposed to the myriad of other activities involved in putting together a bid, why would they do that?
I don't think it is as narrow as you suggest.
How much, and if you were, and I'm not a, well, you aren't either, but let's say you were in that business, what's your best guess of how much time they are involved in actually looking at the plans and specs compared to the total amount of time it takes for them to submit the bid?
Well, it's certainly hours upon hours upon hours, because when it's sections of the work that the bidder itself is performing, there has to be very substantial scrutiny. Examining the plans and specifications and conforming with the statute is not merely the act of looking at it and saying, oh, yeah, I see what this plan means. It is the conduct of creating a bid that is consistent with the plans and specifications. If you get the numbers wrong and you have that kind of mistake, that's what we're talking about. But, for example, in Nelson, there were portions of the bid that were required to be included that the bidder just didn't include. That's a failure to examine the plans and or it's negligence in connection with examining the plans and specifications and conforming with the statute, because you have to put together a complete bid. There are other attributes or submittal requirements associated with conforming with the statute that you have to have a complete bid package. And so examining the plans and specifications and conforming with the statute is not some narrow or minor slice of the process. It is a very substantial, it is the centerpiece of the process.
In fact, if you give that phrase an expansive interpretation, everything you do is included in that. Arguably, calling up and finding, as your opposing counsel notes, or looking up what's the price of steel and what's the shipping cost and all of that, arguably can be, if you interpret it broadly, to be included in plans or specifications examination.
I would think that would be an unduly broad interpretation for at least the following reasons. Much of the work that a general contractor does is actually done by subcontractors. And in this case is an illustration of that. There was a concrete subcontractor who was going to do a very expensive part of the work. The bidder understands what's in the plans, talks to the right contractor, makes sure he or she gets a number for the subcontractor and that the subcontractor has looked at the plans and specifications. But a mistake associated with a subcontractor giving you an erroneous number would not be the bidder's error in examining the plans and specifications. It's something over which you have little control as the bidder and is not actually part of your service. You're just receiving these subbids. Now, that's not entirely what happened here, so I don't want to, you know, make that analogy too close. But that would be an illustration of the type of error that can occur that plainly is not associated with examining the plans and specifications or conforming with the statute.
When you examine the plans and specifications for a project, does it say in those specifications each and every task that you have to perform, or is that part of the judgment of the contracting party to determine what tasks have to be performed to some respect in order to provide the work requested or the complete the project requested?
Typically in contract documents, and more so in public contracts, the work is defined with great specificity. And the reason for that is the owner wants to be sure that the bids it receives allow for an apples-to-apples comparison.
So they're consistent, correct?
Exactly. Now, there are two kinds of instances I can think of off the top of my head where that doesn't happen perfectly. Sometimes there is a specification that says, we want you to use product X, but we'll allow you to use product Y or Z. And so it's called an or equal. There's that kind of flexibility. And sometimes there is part of the work that either the owner hasn't decided what it wants or things haven't proceeded far enough to make that decision. And then there are so-called allowance items. That generally doesn't happen in public construction as much as it does in private because there is less flexibility to ensure that you've got an apples-to-apples comparison.
Thank you.
Getting back to the clerical errors, I just wanted to make a couple of other points. And that is, the vast majority of cases across the country adopt the principle embodied within the clerical judgment type decision, differentiation. Most of them that have been cited, and quite frankly, most of them were cited initially in DOT's brief, adopt either that specific language or something akin to it. But they all recognize the underlying equitable foundations of the right to relief, and that should be accorded where justice so requires. Our statute is by historical precedent and in the literature, an equitable rule. Our courts in applying subsection 5, like our legislature in enacting it, have recognized that error is a human condition and that one may attain a relief where equity dictates, consistent with preserving the integrity of the public bidding process, without compromising it. DOT's position in this case, which is essentially that if it's an error, it's inexcusable, would emasculate the protections that underlie the very purpose of the statute. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cinderbrand. Ms. Gibson?
Thank you.
have just a couple comments on the clerical error exception, and then I'll return to the circuit court's plans and specifications test. Mr. Sinderman suggested that the Marana Court and other cases have said that clerical errors do satisfy ordinary care on a per se basis. I think that isn't in accord with common sense, but the courts make it even easier for us because they tell us they're not going to apply a negligent standard. And in Marana, just as an example, the court says at 717, we reject the reasonable care standard since it appears to be nothing more than a test for negligence. So they're responding to the public authority's argument that the people were negligent in making clerical errors, and they say, we don't care if they were negligent because that's not the test we're going to apply. Now, here we have a statute that explicitly tells us we've got to look at negligence.
Counselor, could you respond to opposing counsel's argument that your interpretation of the statute provides no place for corrections?
Yeah, that's absolutely not true. And as I've said in the briefs and here today, there's lots of errors for which forfeiture, for relief from forfeiture would be granted. Errors happen despite the exercise of ordinary care. And furthermore, there are lots of times when the public authority is going to exercise its discretion, look at all the facts surrounding the making of the bid, look at all the facts surrounding the making of the error, and say, this mistake happened despite the exercise of ordinary care. We're going to let you amend. We're going to let you rescind. But that's different from saying that you have an enforceable right to require the public authority to require that. And Nelson was really clear on that. Nelson tells us that a bidder has no absolute right to withdraw or amend a bid for a public contract, and the governmental body could not be compelled to allow an amendment. And if we create an enforceable right to amend, that is such a dangerous road to go down, because amendment, which is allowed in very few jurisdictions, is something that's just much more prone to abuse. It's a place where you're going to be able to tailor your bid around the other bidders, make it go up, make it go down, whatever you need to do to maximize your profit and do the work at a higher cost to the public. And it's important to note that CAPE has shown us no jurisdiction that applies either a different standard at all for pre- and post-award notification of bids. None. Or anything like the plans and specifications test, where all you have to do is show that you took a good look at those plans and specifications. It's just not out there. And given that we know from Nelson that this statute was a codification, albeit with modifications, of the law of equitable rescission, it would be a strange result indeed for Wisconsin to go out on a limb like that and depart so dramatically from any other jurisdiction. This Court has always construed the bidding statute as for the protection of the public, not the promotion of bidders' interests. Public bidding demands utmost care to avoid fraud, collusion, and improvidence in bidding. The statute must be interpreted to prevent a safe harbor for bidders who decide they've left money on the table and want either to avoid the contract altogether or to do the work at a higher cost to the public. In this case, we have great guidance already in Nelson. Nelson was clear that the standard to look at is ordinary care. The public authority has discretion to allow amendment or rescission, but if ultimately the bidder doesn't get that relief from the public authority, he can always go into court and seek relief from forfeiture. And it's just a plain old garden variety negligence standard. There's nothing draconian about it, particularly not in light of the fact that this is a bidder that has guaranteed this bid to the public. Under that standard, ordinary care is a sensible result and the one that's consistent with the statute.
Thank you, Ms. Gibson, and thank you, Mr. Sinderbrand, for your arguments today on contracting with a public authority. That concludes our hearing in 02-2817, James Cape and Sons Company versus Mulcahy, and also concludes our sitting for the month of May. With that, we are adjourned, and the court will meet in the conference room at 5 after 8. 5 after 3. To me, it feels like 8.